I'd like to present to you now
Ken N. from Portsmouth.
Slick, would you mind if I move this mic back just a little bit? You know, I'm still a thief. I was a thief before I came to Al-Anon, and I'm a thief since I've been in Al-Anon. I just steal different things. I could not help but think of back some weeks ago, some months ago, I was watching an afternoon talk show, and Eddie Arnold was on there. And the crowd gave him a standing ovation at his introduction. And his comment was, "Thank you so much because you humbled me." And I think that's very fitting tonight, that you humble me by asking me to be here this weekend to share with you. I don't know whether I want to thank the committee or not, but I will, out of respect to them, and I want to particularly thank Sue for calling me. If you can't hear me, that's all right. Somebody's going to ask. But if you can't hear me, hold up your hand, and I will try to get the mic a little bit closer, because sometimes I get mic conscious, and I don't like to be mic conscious. You can't hear over in that corner? Which one is for the PA system? This one? Some are sicker than others. Well, my friend Ramona and I were talking a little bit before. Didn't know whether it's better to start or be in the middle or whether to end. I think when you start, you get out some of the wrinkles. You know, you get some of the things ironed out. But I did want to thank Sue for calling me and inviting me. And I have to share with you a little episode that happened when she called me. She called in the extended invitation, and I told her I was very grateful for it, but I had to decline. Because this weekend happened to be the weekend of a family reunion. And I don't know whether it is in your case, but it happened in my case, that we didn't become, as there were six of us children, and we didn't become family-oriented until the death of our mother and father. And when my father passed away, I said to my four brothers and one sister, "Isn't it a shame that we wait until we have tragedy in our family before we get together? Let's start having a family reunion," and this started it. And this happens to be the weekend. So I told Sue that I wouldn't be here. And it wasn't long after that a telephone call came from a very dear friend of mine from South Carolina. And I related to her the incident that had just happened. And I'm going to share with you her comment to me. She says, "Ken, God has given you a gift and an experience that you have to share. And you place first things first." So I called Sue back and thought I would be here. I'm going to get to my story in just a minute, but it's strange. I didn't know what I was going to say when I started. God knew, and he didn't tell me until I stood up. And so as I talk, you're going to find out what he has me to say, because I have no idea. But see, I'm the father of, the brother of, the son of, and the husband of an alcoholic. So what else is new? You know? And the daughter who is in the program, when she came in, I questioned the validity of her being here a long time. I had never known of a drinking problem in her home. One of her sons, who is 17 or 18 years old, he had never known of a drinking problem. No one was aware of a drinking problem that we know of. And I heard someone make the comment out on the porch tonight, the very thing that I want to relate to you. And I was expressing this venom about this daughter being here, which I thought under false pretense. And this happened to be over in Gettysburg some years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago. I was over there on a Saturday night. There was 100 of us sitting around on the floor having a rap session. And a beautiful AA gal across the room, she said, "Ken, what will it hurt?" And I said, "Thank you for allowing me to get out of that prison." Well, this girl is now in her fourth marriage, and she's given away two children to their respective fathers, and she's living in Chicago. Her 17-year-old son came from Seoul, Korea, to be with us this week, and she's come down to join the family reunion, and she called me. And she said, "Dad, and our relationship became very strained during this marriage and this last marriage and during this, her joining the fellowship, more strained on my part than hers. And by the grace of God, this relationship is beginning to heal as of this past Christmas. And she called me back. She said, I think you ought to have second thoughts about going. There are many ways to carry the message. And you know, I'm looking forward to being this weekend with you. And I said, how long do you plan on staying? She says, 2 weeks. And I said, we can share before and after. And I met her at the airport the other night, and she was rather uncomfortable because she knew I was coming. That's her problem. Because you have allowed me the freedom, through the grace of God and your love, to be the better whatever I am today. And I am more comfortable among you than I would be among my brothers and sisters, even though I love them dearly. Because I belong to a group that says AFG, Al-Anon Family Group. And you're truly my family. I would rather be with you than anyone that I know of, anywhere. Now let's get back to the story. My name is Ken Knuckles, and I'm an Al-Anon by the grace of God. Hi, everybody. And I like the word co-alcoholic. I don't know whether you're familiar with it in your part of the country or not. We are exposed to a lot of counseling. We are exposed to a lot of ARC. We're exposed to a lot of treatments in our area because of the government. And in the counseling, we are known as the co-alcoholic. And I will share with you what happened to this co-alcoholic. I choose to believe that my name is Ken and I suffer from alcoholism. Someone that I am involved with in my life drinks it and I react to it. And before my manners fail me, let me thank Esther for picking me up and sharing with me this afternoon. And let me thank Mary for allowing me to heckle her and pick on her this afternoon. And I have to. I don't like to use names and call names because from the podium I think it's sometimes uncalled for. But when I saw a beautiful little redheaded girl from Canada come in and come over and speak to me this afternoon, my heart did flip-flops. Because this program, through the love of God and you, allows each of us to travel various parts of this world and meet and become friends with one another and enjoy each other's company. And I met this little lady in Blackstone not too many months ago, little knowing that I would see her again here this weekend. And she brought someone with her who's been in the program a few months and brought a brand new person with her. Now, I make that statement because I want you to hear what I said. She brought a relatively new person and a new person with her from Canada, willing to go to any lengths. We asked to share what happened to us and how we got here and how it is now. First of all, let me share with you a couple of allergies that I have. Number one, I'm allergic to ties. I'm very uncomfortable with ties. I told my wife that when they put me in that box, if you put a tie on me, I'm going to get up and get you. Don't you dare put a tie on me. Another thing that I'm allergic to is the terminology of male Al-Anon. I am an Al-Anon, and sex doesn't have a damn thing to do with it. And one of my other allergies is that I am not married to an alcoholic. I do not need any subconscious cop-out for my behavior. I am married to a girl. And she says she has the disease, and she calls it alcoholism. And I am not married to an alcoholic. No, sir. This is where I'm comfortable. It may not be where you're comfortable, but that's where I'm comfortable. That's one of the first things that you taught me in this program, learn to be comfortable. Well, to get back to a little bit of a story, and I'm not going to take you through too much because I'd rather talk to you about how it is now. Someone asked me not long ago what Al-Anon is, and I think the best definition I've heard of Al-Anon is the process of becoming. And by the grace of God, I hope I'm in the process of becoming something that I would like to be. But I wasn't what I liked to be when I first came here. I was a result of me, not of my mother, my father, my environment, nobody. I was a result of me. I was an arrogant, egotistical, self-centered so-and-so. I knew all the answers. I knew answers to questions that I didn't even ask yet. If you didn't think I knew the answers, ask me, and I'll tell you something that you hadn't heard, you know. But this is what I brought. I went through life in an early age not accepting responsibility. Now, the things I'm going to share with you, I've only learned as a result of this program. I didn't know these until I came into the program about this individual. I couldn't accept responsibility. I ran from anything that asked anything of me as early as the third grade. I had the worst case of kidneys of anybody in the third grade. Every time a test came up, I had to be excused. So I had to repeat it. And I didn't know that had anything to do with shunning responsibility. Another thing that I learned about me in this program was that I use people and love things. If I couldn't gain something from being with you, I did not associate with you. I grew up when there wasn't any automobiles, very few of them. And if you had a car, I ran around with you. And if you didn't, I didn't associate with you. And I thought this was normal. But let me stop right here, if I may, and also comment that alcohol had nothing to do with my character defects. I brought every one of them to the marriage. Although I blamed them all on alcohol. That was the easiest place to put them. So I went through life, as I said, using people and loving things. I had an experience in my life when I was about 19 years old. I'd gone to Washington, D.C. when I finished high school, and I hitchhiked, and I wound up sleeping in the park benches and the pool halls and bus stations. And I ran around with a group of boys that would roll you for $5 and they'd kill you for $10. And this was back during the 36 and 37, 38. And I wound up getting a job in a drugstore. And the reason I relate this to you is because it has something to do with my story and how it came about, my life became involved with someone else. In order to be acceptable by society, in order to be accepted by you, I was willing to go to any length. And again, I didn't know this about me. In working in this drugstore that I finally wound up getting a job, these fellows would come in and buy 50 cents worth of food and give me a dollar, and I'd give them change for $10. And I didn't get any of this money. Only the fact that I was accepted by them. And one day I was walking across 15th and Pennsylvania Avenue. If you're familiar with D.C., you know it's a very large corner. And all of a sudden my feet were not touching the concrete. Placement under each arm. Now I had a speech impediment so bad that I couldn't tell you my name. And I stuttered for 29 years. As a matter of fact, I stuttered so bad when I went down to meet my wife. At that time, my wife-to-be at her home. Her sister came to the door and said, went back and told her, said, Ann, there's a boy here looking for you, and his chin quivers. I could cuss, and I could sing, but I couldn't talk. And so, you know, this creates a lot of complexes within one. So anyway, I was arrested, I was taken down, I was fingerprinted, I had a number, I was tagged, and et cetera, and et cetera. Some of you have had that experience. And I had met a lawyer in this pool hall that I slept in frequently in the evening, with downtown Washington. And he came to defend me, and he said, Ken, if you will get up in front of the judge and tell him your name and where you're from, that he might let you off. Now, my mother at the time was employed by our local congressman, and I didn't know I had false pride until I came into Al-Anon. And all I had to do was pick up the phone and call Mr. Hamilton and say, Mr. Hamilton, this is Ken, Myrtle's son, and I'd have had a job like that. Oh, I would have gotten out of trouble like that. But I couldn't do that. Something inside of me wouldn't allow me to do that. And so I paid the prices. So the judge told me he would give me a year's probation on the condition that I would be out of town by sundown. So I hitchhiked from Washington, D.C. to Virginia Beach. And I arrived at Virginia Beach about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I went into a drive-in that employed college girls working their way through college. And I met a little blonde sitting on a rail. And somebody said, "Ann, this is Ken, and Ken, this is Ann." And I said, "Hi." And she said, "Hello." And they closed the place up. I ordered a beer, and she ordered a Coke. And they brought the beer over and set it down, and brought the Coke over and set it down, and she got up and started off. And I said, "Where in the hell are you going?" She said, "You drink the beer, you drink it by yourself." And I haven't had a drink since, a beer. I suffer from alcoholism. The girl had never had a drink in her life. 2.5 weeks later, we were married. Real long courtship, you know. By the grace of God, if we see the eighth, that's right, the eighth is this page. You know, some are sicker than others. We have just celebrated 39 years of courting just this past week. And I became a senior citizen just this past month. I'm the youngest 60-year-old man either one of us know. But see, I brought to this marriage an immature adult. I brought to this marriage an unemployed and unemployable individual. And this little gal got me a job. We went to Washington for the winter, and she got me a job. And I wound up moving she and our subsequent children 32 times before I went into the service. I was always looking for it, and when I arrived, it had just left. And I kept looking and looking and looking for it. And one night, she wanted to go to a dance. And this dance was like 100 miles away, and I had to drive 150, 200 miles round trip back and forth to work every day. And I said, "I'll take you to the dance under one condition, that we have a drink." She was 30 years old, 4 children, and married 10 years, and never had a drink of alcohol. And I coerced her into taking that drink. And it didn't do what she wanted to, and she took another and another and another, and she got bombed. And I'm not going to tell you her story. I'll tell you my part of her story. We continued on this merry-go-round for a while, and we didn't have any booze in our life. I still moved my family. I still kept searching for it. I kept being insecure. I didn't know what I wanted out of life. I didn't know what life asked of me. I think I had a 25-year-old body running around and a 12-year-old mind, you know. They tell me that an alcoholic, when he drinks, he starts drinking alcoholically, he stops growing maturely. He stops, my stuttering is going to catch up with me in a minute. He becomes immature. He doesn't mature anymore until he stops drinking. Well, I think I had this problem without drinking. So alcohol had nothing to do with it. I was very immature. So it wasn't too long after this that my wife went over and started drinking by herself. And I don't know how you feel about people you involved in your life, but I'm not a joiner of anything. Either I'm for you or either I'm against you, one way or the other. And I just, that's the same way with marriage, the same way with Al-Anon. Either I'm all the way in or I'm not going to be in at all. And so I took this marriage rather seriously, to the best of my ability at the time. And when this gal started to deteriorate in front of my eyes, I didn't know what to do about it. I'd walk in the afternoon and she'd be sitting in the kitchen floor, bombed out of her skull, sitting around with her hands around her knees, crying. And I'd go crazy. I know what it is to start home and have that gut start turning over and over and over. And that balloon get up here so bad that you can't swallow. And the closer you get to home, the worse it gets. And you walk in the door with fear that's indescribable. And if they're drunk, thank God, because it's what you expected. And if they're not drunk, how soon is it going to happen? And if they're drinking, how long will it take for it to happen? And that's what happens down here in your gut. And you start hurting. And you start doing things that you have no control over. And I'd come home and I'd say, Ann, are you drinking? She'd say, yes. And I'd get a doctor. And I'd get the medicine. And I'd take care of her. And I'd come home and I'd say, Ann, are you drinking? She said, who, me? Certainly not. And I'd go, stop raving mad. I know what the big book says for me when it says the phenomena of the compulsion. Because the compulsion would set into me to destroy that which I cannot control. And I have beat this woman black and blue. I have blacked her eyes. I have broken furniture. I've torn the curtains off the wall. She used to accuse me of beating her so bad so she wouldn't go get another bottle. Did you ever see a woman smash on her makeup? You know, it's nice to laugh about it today. Thank God we have the ability to laugh about it. Did you ever see a mother of four children sit on Sunday morning in front of a mirror, drunk, and trying to get ready to go to church? And the lipstick is up here, and the rouge is up here, and she gets up, she says, they'll look okay. You know, and you die. Damn it, you die on the inside. And your children die. You don't know what to do about it. And you get on this rat race or this merry-go-round. And you say, do you love me? Oh, God, what a cliche. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me enough to quit? Yes. Chug-a-lug-a-lug-a-lug-a-lug. And drive you out of your skull. But see, I didn't know that she meant not to drink. I didn't know that she was being honest. Only until I came into Al-Anon that I learned that she was being honest when she said she did not want to drink and would not drink. This I had to learn through you by the grace of a loving God. I didn't know this otherwise. I came home one afternoon. And I walked in the foyer and my wife was bombed out of a skull. And our daughter came home an hour and a half early from school. And we didn't know why, but today I know why. As she opened the door, I was standing choking her mother, and she was almost as blue as Sue's blouse. I was trying to kill her. This is somebody you love. That's the reason I suffer from alcoholism. That's the reason I'm the co-alcoholic. She wanted to go to a dance one night, and I said, I'll take you, under one condition, that you won't drink. And she said she wouldn't. And two couples start out to dance. And they, as usual, halfway to the dance, we have to stop. The girls go to the John. I never have been able to figure out why two girls go together. You know. I've never seen Bill say to her, you want to go with me? Yeah, you know, let's go. But Jane always says to Mary, you want to go? Yeah, off they go. You know, it's only, And so mostly Ellie and my Ann, they go off to the John, and to the Jane, rather, and, you know. And, oh, incidentally, I'll tell you why I enjoy being in Al-Anon. I'm standing in line to go to the John, you know. It's just me and 25 women, you know. But they go to the back to the trash room, and Moselle comes out, and Ann doesn't. And Ann doesn't. And Ann doesn't, you know. Finally, I get out, and I walk over by that restroom door. And she sashays out, and I grab a handbag out of her hand. She got two medicine bottles like that. One's empty. One's put that much in it. I said, you've been drinking? She says, certainly not. Now, you know, the only thing I've been able to figure out in Al-Anon is perhaps that she thought I was stupid enough that I would believe that she was in there for the last 30 minutes pouring it down the commode and flushing it. No? I think that's the reason I went crazy, you know? But we get to the dance, and she gets worse, and I get worse. About 11 o'clock that night, I grab her up out of the dance, and I get her to the top of the steps, and it's about 10 long concrete steps, and I put my hand behind her and push. And down the steps, she rolls into the bushes. And again, I'll say to the alcoholics in the room, I do not know what the big book says to you, and it says the phenomena of the compulsion. I know what it means for me. I had a compulsion to destroy that which I cannot control. I grabbed this girl up out of the bushes. I was a chain cigar smoker. I took a cigar and buried it in her face. And she carried the cigar for 3 years.
And going home that night, at 35 miles an hour, I opened the door, I put my foot behind and kicked her out on the highway, hoping to God somebody run over and kill her. And I tell you this tonight with no shame and no remorse and no regrets. It took what it took for me to get here. She has forgiven me. I have forgiven myself, and my God has forgiven me. So I'm only sharing with you what alcohol did to me, with no apologies. It wasn't too long after that before she found AA. And let me share with you a very unhappy experience that happened to me in the last 24 hours. The girl that brought the message to my wife some 22 years ago in Baltimore, Maryland, called our home this morning at 5 o'clock from Baltimore, Maryland, crying for help. See, I have an awful lot of fun in this program because you've taught me how to live. But by God, I take it serious. Because I know that somebody tonight may jump off a bridge. And I know tonight that somebody may kill a son or a daughter. And I know tonight that some guy out of insanity may kill a wife that he cannot control her drinking. But I have a lot of fun in this program. And you know, at 5 o'clock this morning, my wife took the phone in the bathroom and sat and talked to that girl for 45 minutes. And for some reason, she hasn't found AA. And for some reason, he hasn't found Al-Anon. And that life went on after my wife found AA. And I became an AAA member. That's an Associated Alcoholics Anonymous member. And I went everywhere she went. God knows we've been all over this country from one end to the other by the grace of God. I've been to retreats. I've been to Al-Anon Internationals with her. I've been to two of those. And I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I thought it was for those who live with, you know, drinking alcoholics if I thought anything. I don't think I thought. I don't think I was capable of thinking. My wife never hinted that I needed help. She never intimated that I needed help. She never suggested that I needed help. She allowed me the dignity to go to hell and to keep her hands off. And she got better and better and better. And one night, going home from a meeting, 13 years after she had been in AA, I said to her, "Why is it that I go out and go to work and you enjoy the fruits of my labor, which as it should be, why can I not enjoy the fruits of your efforts?" And before I finished, I knew what I was saying. Secondhand living. And it wasn't long after that I was privileged to go to a church in my wife's hometown. And I became aware with that statement that it was something I had to do about me. And I didn't know what. And we were in this church, and our son was with us, and my mother-in-law, and my wife. And my wife is a Protestant, and I'm a Protestant. And we, in our church, we have sermonettes. And the minister was talking to little boys and girls in front of the church that morning in front pews. And he held up a poster board, and Charlie Brown and Lucy. Lucy says, "Charlie Brown, do you want to know what's wrong with you?" And Charlie Brown says, "No." The bell went off in my head, you know. You turn it over, and Lucy says, "Charlie Brown, that's the trouble with you. You don't want to know what's wrong with you." Another bell went off. Then after he finished his sermon, then he said to the boys and girls, "Let's sing this without the pianist. Come into my heart. Come into my heart, Lord Jesus. Come in today and come in to stay." And that church shook. This great big 6-foot son of mine, calls me Shorty, reached over and grabbed me by the hand and just squeezed it. Because he could feel that something was happening to his daddy. He didn't know what. I didn't know what. Within 30 days, I was in Blackstone. And I heard a little girl, about 4'9", get up on a Coca-Cola box and talk about Al-Anon. And she and I had lunch together. And we left the room at 3:30 that afternoon. And I found out there was a place for people like me who had a drinking problem but didn't drink, who had a living problem but the absence of alcohol. And I found out about Al-Anon. An Al-Anon meeting. I love what my friend Ramona says. I'm not going to steal her act. She says, don't tell them about the steps. Don't tell them about the slogans. Just love them. Just love them, you know. And by God, that's what you did to me. You just loved me. You loved me well. To whatever degree well I am today, you've loved me there. And so I went into the meeting, and I saw this gal get up, and she says, and I'd known she and her husband for like 7 or 8 years in the program, and she says, oh my God, I'm so tired, and I haven't had time to plan this meeting tonight. And you know, my husband didn't get home till 7 o'clock last night, and I was walking on eggshells. I thought maybe he might be drunk, and I thought, my God, let me get out of here. So I went over to a Friday morning meeting so I could go back and tell the Wednesday night meeting what they were doing wrong. You know? I've been to Friday morning meeting ever since, you know. But that's my introduction to Al-Anon. That was my introduction. And some of the things that you started telling me. See, I had to start getting well before I realized I had been sick. As long as I was sick, I didn't know I was sick. As long as my thinking was screwed up, I didn't know it was screwed up. Because I thought it was normal to have a hangover from screaming at your mate for being drunk. I thought it was normal to have guilt that you couldn't stand for trying to destroy somebody who drank that you couldn't control. I thought it was normal to have headaches and heart palpitations and that gut feeling that your gut's up in your throat and you wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bath and before your feet hit the floor, you know, your motor starts going. And you get back in bed and you can't sleep. I thought this was normal behavior. I didn't know any other way. Until you took me by the hand and said, Ken, Al-Anon has 12 steps. Al-Anon has slogans. Al-Anon has a higher power. Al-Anon has love. You can, to the degree that you want to, as fast as you want to. And if you don't want to, we'll still love you. You can sit there and hurt as long as you want to. We won't think less of you. We won't condemn you. If you want to come infrequently, come infrequently. If you want to come 4 or 5 nights a week, come 4 or 5 nights a week. I don't know how any of you got sick, but I can tell you how I got sick. I got sick 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Now, I'd sure hate like the Dickens think that I could go to school Friday morning from 10:30 to 12 one day a week and get well in 12 years and graduate. I learned through this program we go through three stages. Green, ripe, and rotten. You know? And by God, I don't want to get rotten. So I hope I stay green. And as long as I stay green, there's a possibility of me getting ripe. But if I get ripe, there's a pretty doggone good possibility I may fall off the vine and get rotten. And I don't want to get ripe. I want to stay in the process of becoming, of learning. Because through this program, you've taught me what love is. Love is the answer. Now, what's the question? Love will answer anything in the world. And I will share with you how powerful love is. My friend that I choose to call God had a son. And he said to his son one day, he said, son, I want you to go down and live among my people. And his son said, okay, Pop. He said, what do you want me to tell him? He said, just tell him I love him. How simple. But we, in our intellect, we want to screw the whole ball game up. You know, love with a price tag. I love you if. I love you on my terms, with or without you accepting it. And I choose to believe that my higher power, whom I choose to call God, knew that it took me 13 years to get ready so I could hear what you had to say. People have said to me, aren't you sorry it took you 13 years? No, I'm not sorry. I came in the day I was supposed to. I didn't come a day late or a day early. When the student's ready, the teacher appears. See, I have two people down in here. One is a little black dog and one is a little white dog. And somebody said, which dog is strong? Which dog is the most powerful? I said, the one I feed the most. the one I feed the most. Before I got to Al-Anon, I fed the dog that was insecure. I fed the dog that had resentments. I fed the dog that had hatred. I fed the dog that had all the character defects. And so that was the strongest personality. And now I'm feeding a dog that has different taste and different appetite. Only because you've allowed me to have this nourishment through you and your higher power that you choose to call God. Let me share with you two or three things that have happened to me since I have been in Al-Anon. My wife is one of these AA members that thinks when she's supposed to get up in the morning and she goes to bed at night, she's supposed to do one thing. Serve her higher power. And I tell her oftentimes I wish I was an alky so I could get on the list. You know? But at least she's thinking this happened, you know? Because you leave home and your wife, you know, your spouse is on the phone and they put their hand, bye, you know? And you come home and either they're gone, there's a note there, all these things start going up and you say, well, see, I had these resentments. I need to be among people who are trying to get better. I had these resentments toward my wife's sobriety. Not sobriety, but activity that kept her sober and happily sober. I was at a meeting one night and this AA gal got up and said, before she left to go to the meeting that afternoon, that evening, her teenage daughter said, Mother, I see much less of you since you've been sober and in AA, but I see much better of you. And I said, thank you. See, if I hadn't been in that meeting, I'd still been in that prison. But I had to go to the meeting so I could get out of that prison of resentment. You know, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and I got real smart in Al-Anon. I got so smart before I got to Al-Anon that I was an intellectual snob. I could quote you the big book backwards and forwards. I could quote all the AA literature. And I almost missed this program by 18 inches. It doesn't work right here. It's right here. Not the transcript from here to here. It'll be workable. So because I had all of this knowledge, I stopped dominating my children. I stopped dominating my wife. I found that my marriage license was not attached to my mortgage. Should I say that again? It was a contract to share, not to change. And I thought it was a contract to change the way I wanted it to be changed. And I have four children. God knows I dominated them. And so through Al-Anon, I learned, let's don't be bossy and let's don't be telling them what to do. So I started using another tactic. I started saying, what are you going to do tonight? Well, I'm going to the movie. What time are you going to come home? 12 o'clock. How about making 11:30? No, I'm not managing, but I wouldn't wear that shirt with that tie. You know, we think we've learned a whole lot in this program. We've only picked up the crumbs off the floor of what this program has to offer. You may have picked up more than I have, but that's all I've got. It's just a few crumbs off the floor of what this program has to offer for me. So this particular night, I said to this daughter, my third daughter, I said, Debbie, what are you going to do tonight? She said, Daddy, I'm going to a movie. I said, what time are you coming home? She said, 1 o'clock. I said, how about making it 12:30? I don't know why, and I'm not concerned about the why, but when the children were small, Mother stayed up and Daddy slept. When the children got larger, Mama slept and Daddy stayed up. Okay? So it's about 12:30, Debbie wasn't home. 20 minutes to 1, and Debbie wasn't home. 4 to 1, Daddy's up in the front room. 10 minutes to 1, Daddy's at the front door. 1 o'clock, I'm at the front door. And all of a sudden, Debbie walks in. I think I can repeat to you what happened in the next 12 hours, almost verbatim, as it happened. I don't think there was any animosity in my voice. I don't recall any. I said, Debbie, sweetheart, where in the world have you been? She says, Daddy, I have been in the driveway. She said, Daddy, you would be surprised how many nights I have been in the driveway. The next morning I'm shaving and I'm looking in the mirror. And it dawns on me that I belong to a fellowship that talks about a higher power. I choose to call my higher power God. And my higher power is God. God is my Father and I am His Son. I'm looking in the mirror and I said, look what you've been in your father for 50-some-odd years. And he never once said, can you get better? He never once said, can you? If you don't, I'm gonna. I've done nothing. This daughter's done nothing to me in comparison to what I've done to my father. And my father's only done one thing. With outstretched arms, he says, Ken, I love you. I walked out of the bathroom free. Absolutely free. Of people, places, and things. As of this day, by the grace of God and Ellen, I am as freer than I have ever been in 60 years of living. I don't answer to you or to anyone for anything. I am accountable to my higher power for my behavior. And if you accept it, all right, if you don't, that's your problem. It isn't mine. I've learned to love because when I was growing up, in my speech impediment, I was afraid that if I took your hand, you would reject me. I was afraid to put my arm around you as you may give me an elbow. And I could not stand to be rejected. So this program, I have learned to walk up to the gals and put my arm around them and hug them and kiss them and tell them I love them. And by God, I mean it. Just ain't right for one guy to love so many women. You know? Now I learned to walk up to the guy and put my arm around him and hug him and tell him I love him. And some of them go my friend Doug, who does a lot of taping from Roanoke. Doug has walked up to me on numerous occasions and kissed me on the cheek. The first time he did it, I thought I'm going to die. You know, I can walk up to Doug and any other man and put my arm around and hug him and kiss him on the cheek and tell him I love him. And if you're looking at anything, then they're going to get your problem. It's your own mind. It's your own mind. You've given me a freedom that I didn't know what freedom was. I thought freedom was absence of jail, absence of incarceration. I thought that was freedom. God, I have been in freedom since. I have been in jail since Al-Anon. You think you get an Al-Anon and it all goes away. You know, it wasn't too many months ago that I had to pull the lomis, the plums. And my wife was out on a 12-step call on a Saturday afternoon, and I got out a piece of paper and a pencil. I wasn't going to take an inventory. I wanted to write down how I felt. And I put down on the paper, I feel like all my life feeling so good, I feel so bad. And I wrote down how I felt. But it gave me a freedom. And I didn't know how to do this before I got to Al-Anon. Because, see, in your process of loving me and helping me getting well, you have allowed me to be teachable. And for me to be teachable, I must have a teachable mind, a teachable mind, a reachable heart, and a trainable will. If I have those three things, then I can be taught. I can learn to be different. I can learn to be something I would like to be. I'm not proud of what I brought to you. And I don't say it with any degree of false pride or any degree of conceit when I say to you, but I'm pretty doggone happy with what you've made of me as of today. And I hope that I'll be happy with what you make of me tomorrow. Because if you love me enough, you'll allow me to come back tomorrow and get some more of what you have. You know the joy that I have in this program is to see a new guy and gal come in hurting so bad. They hurt worse all over than they do any place else. And the hardest thing that a new guy or gal has to do is walk through that front door the first time and see them come in and sit down and scared to death. Don't want you to speak to me. Don't look at me. Don't do anything. You know, just leave me alone. You know, got that bundle of nerves. And the first thing you know, after week, they begin to smile. They begin to read. Then they begin to share. Then they begin to participate. And I say, thank you, God, for allowing me to see another one of your miracles. If you don't believe in miracles, stick around and become one. No. Very simple, very simple. God could and would if you sought. Didn't say God could and would if you wished. Didn't say God could and would if you thought. It says that God could and would if you sought. It means I have to take action. I have to do the seeking. I have to do the legwork. You know, like getting out in the middle of the ocean and you drop both oars. You say, oh, God, help me. He says, "Will, but he says, I will, but row like hell, you know. Like, if you don't row, you ain't going to get to shore, you know. I don't know what I've said to you this evening, and I'm not concerned about what I've said to you. I've said whatever needed to be said. I have a story. Someone said to me earlier, do you get nervous sometimes when you talk? I said, yes. Anytime I thought I was going to speak, I would always get nervous. But anytime I thought I was going to be the channel for God, I don't get nervous. I wasn't nervous sitting up here. I'm not nervous now. I may fall to pieces when I sit down, because I'll be in charge then. People have said to me, I'm anxious to hear what you have to say. I said, I am too. I don't know what he wants me to say yet, you know. Because I don't know what needs to be heard out of an experience that God has allowed me to have. I know that whatever I have had to have in order to be where I am today. I've only shared from the podium on three different occasions about my speech impediment. Once was in Tulsa, one was here, and one was in New Jersey. And the first time I shared this was at a 20th anniversary for the New Jersey, for the New Haven Al-Anon conference. And about 500 people, and I walked in. There was a beautiful, well-groomed girl out there, and I met her, and I did my usual bit. I hugged her and kissed her and told her I loved her. And I got up and I told my story about my speech impediment. When I got through that night, she walked up to me and put her arms around me and sobbed for 5 minutes. She said, that's what alcohol did to me. It robbed her of the ability to talk. I didn't know that she needed to hear that night. He knew. He knew. So I don't know what I'm supposed to say to you tonight. It's none of my business. If I become willing, nothing in this program says I have to be capable. It says if I am willing, he will supply the capabilities. And I am trying to become willing tonight to share with you. You know, when we talk about love, we talk about the most precious thing in the world. We talk about Al-Anon love. It's a love that nobody outside can understand. I'm really active in a church, but I'm at home, and I'm not really active in the community of faith, but I'm there. But I can't go to the church tomorrow morning and go back home and sit down next to somebody and say, hey, you know, I tried to kill my wife. God, they moved 5 pews from me. And I don't mean this in any, you know, in any way of judging them. You know? I can't get on a plane and fly from Norfolk to Clarksburg and say, hi, my name is Ken, I'm an Al-Anon. I mean, I'm a Methodist. So? But I can come in and say, hey, my name is Ken, I'm an Al-Anon, and man, I am home. I have never been a visitor in a meeting yet. I am an Al-Anon member, period. Wherever I go. Whatever part of the country it is, I'm an Al-Anon member. And for that I'm grateful. And for that I'm also responsible. Let me share with you the depths of love as I understand it. My friend that I choose to call God came down to earth. And he had a conference with the learned people of the world. He had a conference with those of the church and those of the war. And when the conference was over with, he opened it for questions and answers. And the man of the clergy came up and said, God, tell me, will there ever be one church on earth where brother will be brother and will love one another as they should? And God said, yes, there will be, but not in your lifetime. The man of the war said, God, will there ever be peace on earth where we will not fight nation upon nation and family against family? And God said, yes, there will be, but not in your lifetime. Then Bill W. and Lewis went up. He said, God, tell us, never been anybody big enough to stop and shut up again in Alamon. There will wreck it. And God said, yes, there will be, but not in my lifetime. That's love. That's love. You close to me as you do in an area. Tonight when you're finished. In an area we stand up and we hold hands and we pray together the Lord's Prayer. Now, don't do it now, but I say, if that's the way you close your meeting, you know, when you do that, it makes chills go over me because I am aware that my God knows that I am weak and I fall and I stumble. And he sends all of you to join my hand and make the path a little smoother and a little easier to walk. I couldn't help but think that the three chairs are coming on this podium tonight. The first time I was a little preacher to talk at Alamon Conference was in Louisville, Kentucky. And the chairman got up and read 11 steps and sat down. I don't know whether through nervousness or whatever it was, but he read the first 11 steps and sat down. And there were three chairs. He sat in one, I sat in the other, and the other was empty. And my friend tapped me on the shoulder and he said, don't you know who the third chair is for? I know who the third chair is for tonight. I know who the third chair is for tonight. It might not be your God. It's my God. He's sitting there with me. I don't want to do this today in the morning, if you will. When you get up in the morning, wherever you may be, in your cottage or your room, and if you go to shave, if you go to put on lipstick or whatever the case may be, do me a favor. Look in the mirror and smile real big. And say, hey, there's a guy by the name of Ken that loves you.